Today on Real Ghost Stories Online, a listener weighs in with their stories of paranormal activity and what can be done to deal with it. A grandmother returns for a final goodbye, and one nursing student gets the lesson of a lifetime as she experiences how the dead still may connect with the living.
Welcome to Real Ghost Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802 or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You're about to enter the world of the unknown and quite possibly the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
That it is. 855-853-4802 is our phone number at Real Ghost Stories Online, or write it on the website realghoststoriesonline.com. If you like the show, well then support it. Become an EPP, extra podcast person. We live in a world now where that's kind of how a lot of these things work. So if you enjoy this program, you listen, you're one of the thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands every week that listen to the show, $5 a month is all we ask. Throw it our way, help support this thing, and keep it on the air. Go to ghostpodcast.com. Get access to all the bonus episodes when you become an EPP and advanced episodes of the program, video content, and more. We give you a lot of extras. It's not just, hey, give us money and we'll keep doing this and you get the free stuff. No, you get the free stuff, but you get all the extras, all the bonus stuff, and more there at ghostpodcast.com. Tony and Sean joining you today. And how are you this fine day?
Oh, I'm doing well. And I just have one question for you, Tony.
And that would be?
Be my neighbor. Won't you be my neighbor?
Are you talking about the Mr. Rogers documentary or the Tom Hanks movie?
Neither, actually.
Neither. You're just having a daily Mr. Rogers reference.
The other day in the mail, and now here's a little difference between you and me. You do not have any siblings. I have two. And every now and again, you get a nice little friendly reminder of why you appreciate having a sibling or two on Earth.
And why is that?
Mr. Rogers' sweater-changing mug.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
In the mail, at a hot beverage, and Mr. Rogers changes into his cardigan. So it is a mug, which, I mean, this is nothing new in the technology department. They even had T-shirts back in the day where they were wet, they would change colors. Essentially a mood ring, but in a mug. Where you pop some hot tea or coffee or water or whiskey, and Fred goes from wearing a navy blue sport coat to a maroon cardigan.
That's quite an amazing mug there.
And essentially, it did spur from the documentary. My sister apparently was watching it with her family the other day, and then hopped on Amazon and was feeling nostalgic. She got herself a mug and her brother too.
That's special. That's quite a mug. I too received a mug in the mail this week from a listener. Speaking of coffee mugs, and it's staring at me right now from across the room with those big shaggy eyebrows, and it just wants to say, "I keep forgetting you're not drinking out of me." Somebody photoshopped a picture of me in a video, making this kind of the same expression that Michael McDonald is also making on the mug. And it looks like an album cover. It's me and Michael McDonald on a coffee mug, black and white. And you can see the video up on our Facebook page. It says, I never thought I'd spend one night alone in the bottom.
And I thought my sister's mug was cool. I got to get a new sister. This is fantastic.
It's coffee mug day.
With the bushy eyebrows, I thought that you got a Snuffleupagus mug.
No.
His trunk was the handle of the mug.
No, that would be
that's a lot better.
That would be a good mug, but unfortunately it's not. But this is, I've never had a chance to join in a conversation about coffee mugs, so you brought it up on the right day.
Coming up next week on Mug Chat, lavender porcelain. But first, your 8-day forecast.
855-853-4802 is our phone number at Real Ghost Stories Online. Let's go to our first story. It says of the past few. Actually, this is not a story. This is a news story that we should talk about. Kind of interesting here. Exorcisms in the last decade. Catholic clergy are saying that they've gone up quite a bit in terms of demand. Astonishing number of people undergo deliverance from demonic forces every week, not only in the developing world, but in Britain and the U.S. Pope Francis, who regularly speaks about the devil, has told priests that they should not hesitate to call on exorcists if they hear confessions or see behavior indicating activity. A few months into the pioneering Pope, Francis himself performed an informal exorcism on a man in a wheelchair at St. Peter's Square. The man had been brought by a Mexican priest who presented him as demon-possessed. The Pope intently laid two hands on the man's head, clearly concentrating and driving out the demons. So there you go. Exorcisms up. I'm wondering if this is going to create like a new demand for not just exorcists within the church, but more so exorcists like a box service, like a Blue Apron type deal, where you get like an exorcism kit in the mail, and then you can perform your own exorcism at home. Because why go to the grocery store to get your exorcism kit anymore?
Well, really, if you don't get three taken care of in the first 30 days, we're going to get your money back. We're also going to get you a nice tote bag that says, hell no, exorcism. So call now, be a part of it. And what I think is interesting, bringing into the priesthood, that's a unique place in and of itself. Now, did you grow up Catholic, Tony? What was your religion of choice?
I was mainly Lutheran. My dad was Catholic for a good portion of my childhood. I went to a Lutheran church, though, for the most part. That's where I was a member of when I was a kid. But I would go to my dad's church every now and then. And what I enjoyed there was the kneel portion of it. Lutheran is a lot of stand up, sit down. Lutheran or Catholic, you get to stand up, sit down, and sit on your knees, which was also like, ooh, this is a new added touch.
And when you get to that point in church as an 8 or a 9 or a 10 year old, you can feel the finish line. Once you get to kneeling, because that's right before communion, you think to yourself, I've made it this long. If I am nice and calm and quiet for a little bit longer, we get to go to Burger King. I get to get the bacon cheeseburger. Just calm down, be happy, stay nice. Getting back to the religion, being Catholic growing up, going to confession, I should say, mm-hmm. when you are in a very intimate, small room with a very old man wearing a priest's wear, that in and of itself is kind of a unique situation. But to add now with exorcist and more, that's alarming is what I'm trying to get across. It's already a uncomfortable position as a youngster. I don't know how it is in adulthood. I've not gone to confession in my adult life, but that's a little bit out there to begin with.
So were you honest in confession? I never have been to a confession because obviously I didn't grow up Catholic, but I knew what confession was. But I was always curious, like, were you honest when you went in there when you were a kid and you had to confess? Did you BS your way through it?
Yes and yes. I think here's the thing. Everything is relative.
Yeah.
And clearly I didn't want to be sacrilegious and here's the deal. As a grown up, I go to church every now and again, but I'm not a staunch Catholic and what have you. But I wanted to be honest. I just didn't know, okay, so be honest, but what is the range here? Is this, I went to the gas station last Sunday morning to get my mom a paper, and I put a pack of baseball card stickers in my pocket without paying for them.
I think that's probably when you need to confess. I mean, that'd be like stealing. It's not like everybody does it.
Opposed to, I put the cat in the dryer.
That would be too. I'm thinking like you may not need I don't think I think the lower end of the scale needs to not be baseball cards. So I think that's probably one that would be like you probably need to confess that one. I think the lower end of the scale would be more like I said shit to the dog or something, or like shut up or something. Like probably not the right thing to do, I guess, morally or if according to like laws of biblical laws or whatever. Probably something that you're not going to remember every single incident of every minute thing that you do. But I think the baseball cards probably go up there. Is that something you did quite frequently? Steal baseball cards at the Quickway?
Once. It was not quite frequently. It was once. My mom gave me money, and I remember it vividly. growing up, it matters not whether it's Ohio or a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but I went across the street, lived very close to a gas station. It was a Super America.
Ah, yes.
It was a chain in the Midwest and such. And it literally was that. She wanted me to get her the Sunday paper. And I had the Topps baseball card. It's essentially a card collecting. You had your sleeves and your binders and such, but you could also get the stickers. So there they were, right on the end cap next to the candy bars, and they're like 23 cents. But I put a pack in my pocket. I got home, I put the newspaper on the table, and I ran into the bathroom. I hear a knock, knock, knock about 3 minutes later from my mom. I wait a few more minutes because I had already put the baseball sticker book in the cabinet below the sink. I planned this out. I came out and she said, "Sean, is there anything you want to tell me?" I took a pack of stickers, but I've already put them in the book. I can't return them. I'm sorry. And she did not punish me. She said that the uncomfort of you having to tell me the truth was enough. And then a week or two later, we had confession, and I'm like, okay, can I tell a priest that I said fuck? Or is that like saying fuck in church? And that would be the opposite of confessing. That would make it even worse, because you're saying fuck in church.
Yeah.
So I told him that I stole a pack of stickers, and then I think I went to confession once more in like fourth grade. Mm-hmm. And the next time I'm talking about confession is in 2019 to you and everybody tuning in.
Well, that's good. Just so you know, that one, it's a cardinal sin and you're going to hell. So moving on to our first story.
Son of a bitch!
855-853-4802. It says, "Hey guys, this is Chris from Texas. I finally got off my butt and wrote into the show. My husband and I are listening to your older shows in the car, and we're up to August of 2017, but I cheat and listen to the new ones when I download them. Shameless EPP plug here. I've been an EPP for over a year now, and it's worth it. Do it. You won't regret it. I've written in before since I know what's current to me. A couple of years is old for you two. But first, I want to address something I've heard over and over on your show, most recently on a January 2018 show. Keep in mind, I do not own the Handbook for the Recently Deceased or any other otherworldly rule book that spirits abide by. But I've lived in several houses with personalities, and my sister is an unwilling transphysical medium. Two of my three sons are starting to show signs of similar gifts as well. So it's on my mind a lot lately since I found myself trying to explain to them what they're experiencing. Once we moved out of our childhood home that had very territorial entities living in it that kept out stranger spirits and off to university, my sister seemed to attract spooks to wherever she went and especially where we lived. So I'm basing my views on experiences dealing with everything from mild co-inhabitants to just raise the hairs on your arms and creep you out to lower entities that feed off fear and cause some poltergeist activity and disrupted sleep. The standard disclaimer applies. Your mileage may vary. The caller, Carol Dowd from New York, in the first segment of your show on that day, got angry when the spook threw things at her head and chewed the ghost out. You guys were discussing what worked for her, but might not work for others, or why that worked for her and might not work for others. I believe the answer is twofold. One, she asserted in no uncertain terms that this was her space. She owned it, and the uninvited had to get out. She asserted that it didn't pay rent and was causing trouble, and if it didn't leave, she would call out the big guns and sage your ass out of here to make it leave. This is the most important thing you can do to claim or reclaim your living space from intruding spirits. It belongs to you because it is in the material world, your world. They are ethereal and meant to move on, not linger here. They have to draw energy outside themselves on this plane. They have no internal batteries as we do. Might not work as well if you move into a place that is already infested with strong entities that are fueled by outside power sources, like running water, high tension power lines, Tony's old radio station, or low-level background radiation like decaying granite. But it will offer you some protection from having your energy drained. You have all the power, and they can only attempt to steal it from you for their use. They do this through strong emotion, often fear or anger. Don't let them. Dealing with ass souls is like dealing with human bullies. You have to keep standing up to them until they back down, or you get out of their area. Your belief has to be stronger than theirs. You are the living entity who commands the material world, not them. This is why surrounding yourself with white light works so well. You know that you are a child of the divine, insert entity here, God, Buddha, Allah, etc., and you're protected by that, which brings me to number two. Spirits work on a system of belief. That's why different hauntings seem to be bound by different rules. We could break it down to the quantum level and get all new age and talk about vibration, but this is the easiest way I can wrap my brain around it and explain it to my kids. Human ghosts have some belief in the divine because of the fact that it is so pervasive in our cultures for the last several millennia, and simply from the fact that they still exist. Do sincerely believing atheists come back as ghosts? I'd love to know, they say. That belief binds them to act accordance with the rules that they learned while alive, and in some rare cases, what they learned after death. This is why some spirits will often move through a house regardless of structural changes, etc. They're confused. Much like a person suffering from a high fever or delirium and are walking through what they still believe to be there. What they believe to be true is true for them. Your belief has to be stronger than the ghost belief. This is why sometimes having a pastor or priest come in and bless the house might work or make it worse. How strong is your holy person's faith and your faith in your holy person? Non-human entities take the rules for manipulating the material world from you and therefore are bound by your beliefs. Consciousness and unconsciousness. This is why holy water crosses, salt circles, sage, stuffed animal barriers, prayer, or hiding under the covers works to protect people. If the person using it truly believes it works, then the spirit also believes it works and is bound by it. Here's an example. This is from my own experiences. I grew up with a very strong mother. She was a registered nurse and also naturally very assertive. My sister and I had a couple of cats when we lived together in a house while we attended UNT in Texas. My mother was staying with us and had been complaining about the cats loudly playing in some paper grocery sacks stored in the corner under the kitchen table all night. It had been going on for some weeks and was loud enough for me to think someone was rummaging in there a couple of times, but there was nothing when I investigated. So I learned to ignore it, deciding it was a fan blowing on them, etc. You know, all the little lies you tell yourself about the odd noises at night that you don't want to deal with. My mom didn't ignore it. I kept my cat in my room at night, and my sister's cat was 12 and not very active, so we each said that it wasn't our cat doing it. I was worried it might be mice or something, but neither cat showed much interest in the sacks during the day, so I doubted it was vermin, as my kitty was fairly young and eager to hunt. The next night, when the racket started up, my mother, fed up with it, grabbed a can of Lysol spray from the bathroom next to her room, which she knew terrified our cats, and marched into the kitchen to chase them out. She liberally sprayed under the table in the dark while commanding for whatever was under there to get the hell out of the kitchen right now. This woke me up from a sound sleep since my room was next to the kitchen, and when I went to investigate, she told me what she was doing. I told her my cat was with me in my room. I then checked my sister, and her geriatric cat was asleep on the floor of her bed as usual. No kitties in the kitchen. She grumbled about the noises, and we all went back to bed. Strangely enough, there was no more rattling of the sacks under the table after we went back to bed. It stayed quiet in there too. That particular manifestation never returned. So that's the story of how my mother exorcised a ghost with a can of Lysol spray and profanity. Because she believed it would drive away the noisy critter, it did, and the spook left. Whether everything works just as I explain it does or not, I believe it does, and that's what matters for me and any spooky encounter. If you'd like, I write in again with more stories of the spirits and spooks I've encountered over the last 49 years, including the gremlins that my mom and grandmother insisted lived in the 100-plus-year-old house I was raised in. Love the show. It's making me examine how I think the spirit world works. Thanks. Thoughts?
What the hell was in the kitchen?
Something. It wasn't a cat, but something that then abided by the belief system that she explained, which is interesting because sometimes we do have those stories where somebody just commands something to leave. And to me, when I first started doing the show, I thought that was one of the silliest things you could do. If it's a ghost, if it's a haunting, why on earth is it going to listen to you? But more times than not, having done, I don't know how many tens of thousands of stories now, it seems to be one of the most effective ways of dealing with these things. And, you know, it's surprising because it doesn't deal with everything, but quite often it does work by just almost reasoning with it and saying, get out, this is not your place, this is my place, and you can't be here. Or if you're going to be here, I don't want to know you're here. And sometimes that seems to be one of the more effective routes of dealing with something.
What's interesting when they made reference to it's almost like a bully, mm-hmm. but from the other side, and it's very interesting to be in a situation like that to have a discussion, have a constructive criticism of sorts to get out of here as though you're speaking to the fifth grade bully at Johnson mm-hmm. Elementary, when really a part of your brain is shitting their pants because you're wondering what the hell is that. I cannot see it. It's clearly here. But then to have the insight to be able to calmly, effectively say, mm-hmm. no, this is not happening here. Get out. Don't come back, et cetera, et cetera.
I would almost argue that sometimes dealing with ghosts and essentially saying, look, you can't be here. This is my place. They're more reasonable than the living. At this day and age sometimes. Because the ghosts, you know, these days, you know, if you talk to anyone under the, I don't know, I'm making a generalization here, but under the age of 25 or so, could be even a little bit older, I suppose. You know, if you try and impart some advice or just rules of any sort of like, you know, you really, you know, you should think about doing it this way, because if you do it that way, it's not going to turn out correctly. I've done that. It didn't work. You're not the boss of me. You can't tell me what to do. You know, that's kind of what you get a lot now. And you don't get that from ghosts. Ghosts are kind of like, ah, fuck, I'll get out of your bedroom. But they're not like, you can't, this is, I'm going to sleep here. I want to sleep on the Tempur-Pedic mattress because I got a bad back and I know I'm dead, but it's still, you're not going to get that shit. But if you happen to intervene with your 28-year-old that's still living at home that decided they want to use your bed, no, you can't sleep in my bed anymore, Junior. You're 28, probably time to get a job and stop playing Fortnite. You're not the boss of me. Actually, I kind of am. You're living in my house. You're not the boss. Yes, I kind of. Yeah, you're not the. Then it's a cycle that doesn't fucking end. So. Yeah, it's the you're not the boss of me shit that I think maybe it's just people of a different generation that are the ghosts where that wasn't the thing. It was more like, I'm going to listen to authority. I'm going to listen to someone with a little bit more experience than me, and maybe I'll get something out of it and not think I know everything until I failed at everything and I'm living in the gutter and the dumpster behind Lowe's. But, you know, to each their own.
More heartwarming stories next.
I'm Delilah. Love someone tonight. 855-853-4802. Our phone number at Real Ghost Stories Online. Next one says, Dear Delilah, I was 12 when my grandfather passed away. He was really good for me. I loved my grandfather very much. He'd walk to me to elementary school and walk me back every single day. And by the way, I have a Delilah story I will tell after this story. So remind me, because it's pretty good. During the last few years, he suffered from strokes, 3 total. The second stroke is the one that placed him in a nursing home. This was hard on my grandmother and her family, as it was the realization that he's not only suffering, but close to his time to leave us. When he had his third stroke, I was walking from school alone when my father saw me and pulled over to pick me up. He told me what happened. We went to my auntie's house where all the family gathered. Walking in, everyone was sad, and my grandmother was crying, as was my mother and my aunt. He had passed away. My heart sank, and this was my first personal death experience. I didn't know how to react other than remembering the good thoughts and times we spent with him. Of course, being 12, death was only a far concept, let alone I didn't even think about ghosts or anything of the paranormal sort. But this is where it all started. Our family stayed at my aunt's house in the next few days, so we're all together and can comfort each other. The third day after his passing, this was my experience of anything paranormal and made my realization of many things come to light. It was late at night. I don't recall the time, but I can recall waking up to my grandmother giggling in her sleep. She slept next to me in the same room. I was close to them both, my grandparents. Well, she was giggling, and I asked her, Grandma, are you awake? Knowing well she was sleeping, but she answered me in her sleep, eyes shut. It's okay. It's just your grandpa tickling my feet. He's come to say goodbye. And then I'll see him soon. This shocked me as a child. I looked towards her feet. I saw my grandfather, but only lower legs down. It was strange. Not in a scary way, but I felt warm. No fear or threat. What I recall was white powdered legs, ankle and feet with slight transparency, literally like something from a 70s ghost movie. I then saw him walk away down the hallway to the stairs. I heard him walk down and out the front door, opening and closing the door. Looked at my grandmother and I smiled, and then went back to sleep. The next morning, I awoke early. I walked downstairs and checked the front door. It was unlocked. I walked outside, most likely to see if there's someone there or footprints. I walked back in, closing the door and locked it. I walked into the kitchen and saw my aunt. "You saw Grandpa last night, didn't you?" she asked me. And that's the end. They all saw him. What was your...
Holy hell.
What was your first death experience as a kid? If you had one. Who died?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Tony. First time, long time. I brought my grandpa up. This was August of 1994, so mm-hmm. I would have been 12.
Yep.
And my grandpa went into surgery. I want to say it was double, triple bypass, and ultimately never came out fully of surgery. And I can just remember my dad coming over to pick us up, and we're in, I don't know whether we pulled over to the side of the road or we're at a red light, but my sister, my oldest sister, was coming back from, it was during the summer, and she was a camp counselor at a camp in Pennsylvania, so she was still traveling back. So it was my other sister, myself, and my dad were just sobbing uncontrollably. I mean, the crying when you literally almost run out of tears mm-hmm. and your stomach is so it's like you just did 3,000 push-ups, sit-ups. And it was just this pure overwhelming, just got to get it out. And then you go through the whole wake and the funeral, and then that presents a whole new sadness, but you've already cried so much. It just such a unique and I cannot remember. Well, I will say, and maybe you're going to ask it next, but the one time that I did remember my grandpa coming back, for lack of a better term, is every year. And his birthday, he passed away on August 7th. His birthday is August 18th, so he almost made it to his 77th birthday. And every birthday, my dad goes and visits him. He is in a mausoleum. And actually, my grandma, who has since passed on, is cremated right next to him. So he goes and visits him on his birthday every year. And I talk to him, my dad, before he goes, and amidst the conversation, talking about the Brewers or this, that, or the other. Because usually when dads call you and they miss their children, they don't just call and say, "I miss you." They talk about anything else aside from "I miss you" mm-hmm. and what have you. And at the end of the conversation, said, "Well, say hi to him for me," referring to my grandpa. And the goosebumps and the hairs on the back of my neck. I mean, sometimes that happens and you think, "Oh boy, that was something," but then multiplied by about 7,000%. And I thought to myself, "Well, he's coming back to say hey," talking about him, and it's like he's in the room there talking along with us.
I would say the first one that stood out to me was I was, probably like 7 or 8, right around there. It was my dad's grandma who had passed away, and she'd been in a nursing home for quite some time. So it wasn't like, it wasn't shocking. It was kind of like, well, we know it's coming. And it came, and I didn't really know what to make of it. I enjoyed visiting her. I didn't know her that well, even though we went and saw her all the time. But, she, when we were, going and seeing her, she didn't communicate all that much. The most we did, we played bingo at the nursing home at least once a week, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And you did it with playing cards instead of a bingo board. It was a little easier. It was like Jack of Spades. And if you get 3 in a row, you get the prize. And prizes ranged from an orange to a dime and sometimes a candy bar. And it was great fun. My great-grandma, incidentally, with candy bars, quite often would sit on them in her wheelchair and Star Crunches, Little Debbie Star Crunches. And when I'd go and see her, she'd offer me one that she'd been sitting on all day. And it was a little melted, but you're not going to turn down a Star Crunch. And
no.
I just got to say, the crunch was kind of lost at that point, but was still enjoyable. You still got the cookie feel, and you still got the caramel and the delicious chocolate coating. Anyway, that kind of went off my story, but she passed. And I didn't really know my family, because it was my dad's side. And it was interesting. It really, you know, we went to the funeral. Everybody, you know, they seemed kind of already having accepted what happened. And then it like turned into a giant party. Like I think we ended up at my parents' house. And they're drinkers and all that. And there was like me and my cousins were hanging out. It felt like Christmas without presents. Like everybody was hanging out. We had food and we had drinks and we were playing. And it was probably one of the more fond memories I have of childhood, hanging out with that side of the family, because that side of the family didn't get together all that frequently. Outside of like a Christmas get together, I enjoyed hanging out with. I have nothing bad to say about them. It's just we didn't get together that much. But that was, I have to say, probably one of the funnest times we ever got together was when my great grandma kicked it. So I don't know what that says about them, but there you go. And thereafter too. Anytime anyone died, anytime any of the older generation died, whether it be a great uncle or aunt or somebody, there was always like, whose house are we going to for the party? And, you know, I guess it's I mean, there's a lot of cultures that do celebrations. I think they did it inadvertently, or it was Wisconsin and they just needed another excuse to have beverages on a Tuesday. I think might have been more like that. But
hey, I think any opportunity to get together people that don't often get together, whether it is Irish Fest, whether it is death, or somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy each other's company.
Yeah, they did it without really realizing they were celebrating, I think, without realizing they were celebrating. And that's kind of my take on it. Maybe I'm missing it. 855-853-4802 is our number at Real Ghost Stories Online. Another story says, I remember the first and last time I saw a ghost when I was in fourth grade. It was very terrifying when a chubby girl wearing a black dress and waving a black handkerchief was floating right in front of me in the kindergarten room of our school. It was my first and last time I saw one beyond what my eyes can see, but hearing unusual voices and caresses of weird wind never stopped until I reached my present age. It always made me feel goosebumps, although I'm trying to ignore it. In my third year of nursing right now, and we already have had our practicum in the delivery room, I never heard such ghostly stories before in that area of a certain hospital. I'll not mention the hospital's name. It was my first time then to have my practicum in the delivery room, and our shift is from 11 p.m. until 7 a.m. the next day. We only had two patients in the labor room at that time. At 1 a.m., one of the patients gave birth, and right after the delivery, she was transferred into her desired room at the ward. So me and my co-nursing students would remain in our area and monitor the patient left in the labor room. Everybody was tired, of course, including the staff, and a few minutes after the delivery, everyone seemed to fall asleep. I was the one left awake, cleaning the Kelly pad and whatever doctor instruments we needed to. I felt weird at that time. It was uncomfortable just doing my task, but I just ignored it. While cleaning the instruments, I felt somebody walking behind me. I thought it was one of my classmates, so I turned around and tried to approach something. But when I turned, nobody was there. Only a gust of wind that passed through me. Gosh, that's weird, I told myself. Well, I continued what I was doing. Later, I felt very sleepy, too. It was already 2:30 a.m. in the morning. I walked into the labor room to check the vital signs, and I sat in the chair, the corner of the door, near the one of the beds in the labor room. Closed my eyes, leaned my head on the wall, and suddenly something tried to wake me up. I slowly opened my eyes and saw someone pacing around the labor room door. I thought it was a staff nurse giving medicine to the patient, but it wasn't. The figure was actually smaller in size than that of an adult. I tried to figure out who she or he could be. When my vision seemed clear, it was a little boy. It was a little boy even though he was not facing me. He was jumping and jumping at the other corner of the labor room. I wondered how this little boy got inside. I tried to stand up and ask him, but I couldn't move. Even my fingers couldn't move, and no words would come out of my mouth. I told myself this is not normal anymore. That little boy in a white shirt could not be like me. He could be the others. My heart beats very fast. I didn't have any idea what to do. Everybody's still sleeping, and I can't even cry for help because I can't speak. Cue Rick Astley. Cry for help. Okay, continuing on. Again, I felt goosebumps, and another weird gust of wind passed through me that made me feel cold and chilly. I said, calm down, Jess, calm down, pray, pray, pray. And so I did. Then everything shut down after my last prayer. I heard voices around me. It slowly opened my eyes. Then I saw some of my classmates were awake, and they were monitoring the patient. I looked at my wristwatch, and it was 5 a.m. It was so weird and scary. I tried not to tell anyone until 7 a.m. I asked my classmates if they felt something that's not right in the delivery room. Half of them said they had. Another half noticed nothing. Weeks passed. We returned to the delivery room for our next concept. We're in our afternoon shift, and lucky for us, we don't have any patients to monitor in the labor room. So our clinical instructress discussed something related to our concept, and the discussion switched into some ghostly stories. I kept my mouth shut. I tried not to tell anyone about what I had experienced during my last duty. And one of my classmates talked about some ghostly stories about the area that she heard from the students. She heard that there's a spirit of a little boy playing along the labor room door. As well as my clinical instructress, she opened us up to us about her personal experiences in the labor room. Then I knew that it was the same as mine. There you go. Isn't it nice when we can interject just a little bit of Rick Astley into a story?
I actually wanted more. I don't know why you went back to the story, but...
Well, you don't want to give too much Rick Astley because it'd be too much of a good thing.
What's interesting is, and I would imagine there are many stories. Someone listening right now may have 3, 4, or 5. A place where you have not only so much death, but so many times where a patient has left us, mm-hmm. they've been revived, they've left us again, and so on. And my real question is, in a hospital type setting, patients that can be gone for who knows how long, a half hour, where you have teams trying to revive them, such, do you believe in that short amount of time where they technically are no longer living, if somebody or part of them goes to the other side, they then come back living, but there is still that being or a part of them on the other side that is wondering, what the fuck? Wait a minute. You were gone for a half hour, 45 minutes. You were in a coma for several months. The fuck? Now you're back living? Who are you? And then they just stay around the hospital. They visit other people who do pass on, and there are, they kind of go into the afterlife and they kind of welcome them. Okay, this is what happens. They're going to move your body, and then there's going to be a funeral, and this is how this plays out. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that there's anything to that, or you believe that upon dying, there needs to be a week or 2 weeks or a month to make sure, okay, you're still not alive, and then whatever will be on the other side will become?
Like, you're around there, like you're still technically being kept alive, but you're not a fish, your heart's still beating, but your consciousness, your soul or whatever, is wandering around, is what you're asking.
But even in situations where hearts stop, I mean, you okay. hear countless times in surgery or the sure. car accident or whatever the case may yeah, be, okay. where the actual person who is now living,
so kind of in that,
it,
in that
actually
in
blue lined or red lined or whatever the medical term is, you were dead for X amount of minutes and we brought you back.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it's a possibility. There's so many stories like that you cannot really explain. And then quite often when that sort of thing happens as well, those individuals who may have never believed in ghosts before or anything of that nature, even if they did, but never really had many experiences, quite often for the rest of their lives, it's called the thinning of the veil a bit, where you suddenly, you may end up getting some abilities you didn't have before, and you're able to sense and feel more things on the other side than you may not have been able to previously. I think some folks are born with it, where they have that thinness. And then some are able to, I think one of the only ways really to pick it up later in life is to have an experience, essentially a near-death experience, to thin that veil, where you end up being able to sense things on the other side to such an extreme level.
I would imagine that... That'd be interesting that there was just this one occasion, this little boy. I'm curious how many more stories that this nursing student has that she hopefully will share in the future.
I think probably quite a few. I wanted to mention Delilah earlier. Of course,
I wrote it down. I was going to say Delilah.
Are you excited? Yeah. So we'll wrap up with this. So Delilah, if you're unfamiliar, is a syndicated radio show that goes out to hundreds of radio stations around the country. It's a love song show.
Yep.
If you listen to your local adult contemporary station from 7 to midnight, you got pretty good odds that you're going to hear Delilah on. Anyway, she's been around for a long, long time, and it's a syndicated, like I said, show. What that means is she's at one place and it goes out to hundreds of places. She's not at the station as much as stations try and make it sound like she's sitting there in Paducah. She's not. I think she's in Seattle. I could be wrong. I had a friend who was a producer of her show for a while. Anyway, when
59
I was
59 years old.
Okay. When I was starting in radio 20 some years ago, my first station, we picked her show up at night and started running it. And it's produced to a level where when the host is done saying their national spiel, that's generic, that can go out to the country, she presses a button and then it sends this signal to all the stations that play a pre-recorded version of her saying the station's call letters. So she ends it with, "Thank you for your caller. Press the button. I'm Delilah."
On Mix 94.7.
Exactly. So sometimes it sounds natural. Sometimes it sounds very canned. Anyway, that's how it's done. But sometimes it's down to a level people actually think she's at your radio station. So as a 16-year-old who loved to screw with people, and I guess as a 36-year-old. Am I 36? No, I think I am.
I was going to say, when did that stop?
Yeah, as a 36-year-old. I still love to screw with people. But back then, there was far less, thought on what repercussions could be. So what I would do, people would call the radio station. I was doing the rock show at night across the hall on the rock station, and the station across the hall played Delilah. But you could answer the phones for any station in my studio. So I would constantly be answering the phones and airing the calls as Delilah. On my station. So people are calling, you know, with these heartfelt stories, and I'm talking like a Delilah in drag, because I'm like, "Hi, it's Delilah." And, you know, I obviously don't really sound like Delilah, but I tried it, and I swear to God, people really, they were so interested in talking with her, they just overlooked that little fact that this sounds like it might be a teenage boy doing the voice of a 38-year-old woman. They told me their stories, and I would always like, "That's special. I'm so glad that you found the love of your life, but have you considered Steven from high school?" And they'd be like, "What?" Like, "Well, remember, maybe, was it somebody else in high school?" And they'd be like, "What are you talking about? Remember we went to high school together?" And I'd make up stories like they knew me. They're like, "Oh, yeah." And people go along with shit so easily. It's unbelievable. And they'd be like, "Yeah, I think I kind of remember you. I think we were in Miss Jenkins' geometry class." Like, "Yeah, I think we were." And was it Steven you liked? And then they'd bring up, "No, it wasn't Steven. It was Billy." And, "Yeah, Billy, that's what it was. Did you ever think about reaching back out to him? I heard he's having problems in his marriage." And these people would be like, "Oh my God, I don't think I should do that, Delilah." "Yeah, you're probably right. Let me play some Celine Dion for you." then I'd like, that'd be the end of the call. And then I'd take it and I'd air it on the rock station, and it would like go into like, I don't know, like Nirvana or something. It would be Celine Dion. It'd be like Smells Like Teen Spirit would suddenly come out after that. But yeah, that was the shit I would pull. I don't know how the hell I didn't get fired. I don't know. I guess we're in a different place in time where there wasn't really, you know, internet to the point where someone could capture this audio and play it back and get me in trouble with, you know, the syndicator, with the Delilah show at that point in time. But I don't think anyone could pull that shit off today without getting in some serious shit.
And really, it takes a fellow radio person. I mean, you can compare it to any situation, whether you work in HR, somebody coming in and talking to you and confiding, when really they think they're coming into the HR office. You're in accounting. You're doing something entirely different. All of a sudden, somebody sits down. "I need to tell you about Derek in custodial." And you, at first, your face is like, "The fuck?"
Yeah.
And immediately you just go with it. "You tell me about Derek. That's right. He didn't empty your garbage 3 days in a row. You have to just put yourself in a position, and you're not trying to genuinely fuck with people's emotions. Mm-hmm. But really, it's an enjoyable evening.
It was. It made for great radio. It was.
I just want to hear these. Did you record these in any fast?
Yeah, you know, I have a box of reels in the other room, and I don't have a reel to reel player. I every time I see one in an antique store, I'm always like, I should try and get with this reel to reel player and see if I can get mm-hmm. some of the stuff off these tapes. I have a couple things that I've rescued off reels when I found them over the years, but I still got a lot of stuff that just sits. Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear some of that stuff. The funny part two to that story is last year, maybe 2 years ago, my parents went on this cruise that it was the Yacht Rock cruise that had like Michael McDonald and Christopher Cross.
Tell me they met Delilah.
Delilah was on the cruise. And,
oh, son of a bitch.
And my mom, in all of her infinite wisdom of how awkward can we make this moment,
told her the story.
Goes up to Delilah and says, she's like, oh, my son used to be a big fan of your show. She's like, oh, really? She's like, yeah, he used to work at a radio station that carried it, and then he'd always answer the phone as you. I said, well, how the hell did she respond to that shit? And she's like, she just looked at me really strange. Like, what did you expect her to do? Like, you come up to this woman like, my son used to answer the phone as you. Like, what? And she doesn't know the context of this. Just this random woman comes up to her and says, my son used to answer the phone as you.
So my son, current day Rachel, used to answer the phone as you and is just a big, big fan.
You know, in her mind, she's like, oh, your son was like dressed in drag answering the phone as me in your basement.
Yeah.
Not like, yeah. There was no context to the story whatsoever. Just go up and tell Delilah this little factoid and see what the fuck happens.
And we're on a boat together. So you're on a boat. I cannot outrun this crazy person.
It's just like, if there's any way to make this as awkward as humanly possible, let's do it. And that's, you know, and then wonder why it was awkward. You know? It's like, okay, there we go.
And then your mom had an anti-skip Sony Walkman CD player, and she put headphones on Delilah and played Hootie and the Blowfish. Hold my hand.
And picture the entire story being delivered in the strong Wisconsin accent. Yeah, my son, he used to answer the phone as you all the time, Delilah.
Would you like some cheese on my cheese plate?
Did you try the midnight buffet last night? Wasn't it just yummy? Like, oh my God. If I were Delilah, I'd lock myself in a room on that boat and hope to God it hits a fucking iceberg. Although, there you go. Then half the audience is gone. So that's the story. That's the story of Delilah, kids. And that's going to wrap up.
This is
up
Delilah on Light 94.7.
And that's going to wrap up the program for today, everyone. If you like the show, keep us on the air. Become an extra podcast person. Go to ghostpodcast.com. $5 a month. Get access to all of our bonus episodes and advanced episodes. Everything is right there. $5 a month. That's what supports this thing and allows us to keep it ongoing. Ghostpodcast.com. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to another episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. Love someone tonight.